about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Morgan Lyle, and he'll be answering your most important questions on simple flies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Morgan a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Morgan Lyle about simple flies. Royal Gorge Angler is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Before we introduce Morgan, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Morgan's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Morgan's latest book, Simple Flies, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So here's how you can win Morgan's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Morgan's book, Simple Flies. Our guest tonight is Morgan Lyle. Morgan is the author of Simple Flies, 52 Easy-to-Tie Patterns That Catch Fish, published in July 2015 by Stackpole Books. He has been a regular contributor to American Angler, Fly Tire, Trout, The Drake, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and other magazines, and has been the fly fishing columnist for the New York Outdoor News since 2004. He's a former fly fishing writer for About.com and blogger at The Fly Line. A longtime journalist, his work has appeared in media, including Newsday and The New York Times. He learned to fly fish on the Esposas Creek in Catskills and lives in Brooklyn, New York. In his book, Simple Flies, Morgan examines how and why extremely simple flies work so well for trout, bass, and saltwater fish, and is an excellent introduction to fly tying for the beginner tire. Author and Orvis Rod and Tackle Market Manager Tom Rosenbauer said, "This is one of the best fly tying books I've seen in years." Morgan, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thank you so much. It's great to be here, and I'm so sorry to have thrown you a curveball with that creek that you were struggling to pronounce. Oh. Even people who grew up near it sometimes mispronounce it, but it's Esopus Creek in the Catskill.
Esopus, okay. Now, Esopus, and yes. I'm known for mispronouncing things, so
I'll believe
I'm kind
you.
Of used to it.
It's an often mispronounced word.
Yeah, yeah. And my lady friend is so good at that stuff, so, you know, she's constantly correcting me. So, so like I said, I don't feel bad, but Esposas, huh?
Esopus.
Oh, Esopus, see? I can't even do it after you tell me what it is. Anyway, okay. Let's look at what we've got here for questions. Let's start out with probably the most obvious question of all is, why did you write Simple Flies?
Well, it's because I had begun experimenting with some very simple flies, And it began to occur to me that nobody really had done a sort of a long-form treatment on the subject of why flies that are only made of one or two things and were very simple to make and the materials they were made of are very commonplace and easy to obtain, why those flies would work so well when we fly tyers have been, you know, really striving for centuries to make our flies more complex, more detailed, more quote-unquote realistic, however you want to describe it. And yet, you know, throughout the years, there have been a few very simple patterns that have just worked great, and I just began to think of it as a fascinating subject. So I started doing some research and reading and interviewing some folks, and it turned out to be what I thought would make a pretty decent book. And fortunately, the folks at Stackpole Books agreed with me, and here we are.
Is this something you've taken on personally as a fly fisher to fish more simply? I mean, overall,
Yes and no. These are the flies that I fish when I go fishing. So, yeah, in that sense, I certainly have. Mainly because I've just had such good luck with them, I don't really see any reason to use anything else. And then I should say, too, that, you know, I don't for a second mean for this book to be dismissive or disparaging of people who do like to tie complex flies. We're sort of in a golden age of it right now. When you see all the great stuff that's being tied, you see people online and there's the whole modern streamer school of fly tying, including some good friends of mine who are real masters at the art. So I certainly don't mean to suggest that there's anything wrong with making flies that really are involved and detailed and complex. But I've just found it kind of fascinating that these very, very basic patterns work so well, and I think it sort of says a lot about, I think it's sort of instructive about what really motivates a fish to bite.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the is it alive kind of thing. If it looks alive, then it's probably going to work.
That is absolutely the key factor, if it looks alive. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think you're catching more fish now using the simpler flies than you did with the more complex flies, or is it the same, or?
You know, I don't know if I'm catching more fish. If I am, it's only because I'm fishing with more confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've come to really believe in how effective those flies are. And as I think we all know, if you believe in your fly and fish it confidently, that's a large part of the battle right there.
Yeah, it's you know, you always hear that, and it's, you know, you go out with guides and they fish the same flies every day, and it's probably confidence more than a lot of things, and them knowing where to put that fly too, which many of us in a new area, you know, struggle with. But day after day, fishing the same places, fishing the same flies, you've got to develop confidence. So, yeah.
Sure, and yeah, it really is knowledge, local knowledge, and it really is fishing carefully, fishing well. You know, it sort of goes back to what I think is a pretty well-accepted school of thought in fly fishing, that presentation is more important than pattern, and I guess the saying is that the wrong fly fished well will do better than the right fly fished poorly.
Right, right, yep. We got a question in, and comment, kind of comment question, from Richard Bauer in Pennsylvania, and here's what he wrote. In many respects, simpler patterns can be better. In your book, you have a quote from Datis Proper. I consider his book, What the Trout Said, to be one of the better angling books I've read. But in it, Proper really does not clearly tell us how he reaches a reliable and reproducible conclusion about what the trout say about a fly pattern. How do you reach a reliable conclusion about the effectiveness of your patterns, and what are your metrics?
Well, first of all, I guess I should point out that while there are a few flies in this book that that I sort of developed on my own, a great many of these flies have been around for a very long time in one form or another, and they're all attributed to the people who first dreamed them up. When you ask about how you reach a reliable conclusion about the effectiveness of a fly, it's pretty simple. Is it catching fish or not? And is it catching fish frequently enough that it's not a one-off thing, that it's not a fluke, you know? And I guess that's what Richard's asking about when he talks about, you know, reproducible conclusion. You know, it's really, really I don't know that it's at all possible to measure in any sort of scientific way whether one fly is more effective than the other, because there are just so many different variables involved. I mean, that come down to things like, you know, whether the fly happened to float past the fish in such a way that the fish even noticed it, or whether the light was just right and it just sort of, you know, caught the fish's eye and rang a bell for it. So, and there are so many variables involved that I don't know that you can make a scientific comparison of how one fly works much, much better than another. I think if your flies are catching fish, your flies work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's, and like you say, there are so many variables. You can't even float, you know, two flies through the same piece of water, you know, realistically, because, you know, it's just not going to go in the same place. And the fish may not be
really
in the same
can't.
Place. And, yeah, it just goes on and on with variables there.
It's like the old saying that you never step into the same river twice, because the river itself is changing constantly, second by second. So.
Right, right. I did an interview with Ralph Cutter on, and it was on fish food. He wrote a book on fish food. And one of the things I remember from that interview was he did a lot of underwater observations, and his take was, listen, after I've watched these fish down there, they're taking in just about anything and everything that's coming down the river. Rocks, stones, sticks, bugs. And he says, granted, they'll spit a lot of it out, but they're tasting a lot of, you know, it's like a, you know, they're not quite sure. This stuff is coming fast, and they're not quite sure, and they're going to take it and check it out. And so his theory was not so much, he didn't put much importance on what the fly was. It was just getting it in the right place, you know, because they'll probably taste it if it is, and it looks like it's alive. So that made me think a little bit differently about, you know, making it more important to get it in the right place than what the fly actually was, you know. So,
yeah, I think he's absolutely right, yeah.
Okay. Now, since you started kind of backing off on and tying the simpler flies, and like you said, some of these are old classics, or maybe simplified old classics, but some of the old classics were simple, too, to begin with. Have you simplified your rod, line, and reel, or are you, you know, have you gone the Tenkara route, or are you still with the reel and a standard, you know, fly fishing rod?
Yeah, no, I haven't really changed my tackle very much. This is really about the you know, the flies that I'm using, but I do use Tenkara gear quite often. And honestly, the Tenkara movement was one of the things that got me thinking about very simple flies in the first place. And as a lot of your listeners probably know by now, sort of a big part of the Tenkara ethos is that those guys over in Japan, they rely on a very basic selection of very simple flies. They're usually wet flies, very simple ones, not usually nothing more than a body and a hackle, and they look an awful lot like the wet flies that we in the West are familiar with from the British Isles, the partridge and greens and so forth, flies like that. And so back in 2009, at the time I was writing a newspaper column on fly fishing for the sports page of the newspaper where I had worked. And it was a weekly column, and so I really needed to find a lot of stories. You know, it was a very hungry thing. And I heard about this wild method of fishing with this, you know, collapsible 12-foot rod with no reel, with the line tied directly to the tip, and it sort of intrigued me journalistically, you know. So I began looking into it and covering it, and I've been covering it on and off ever since. And of course, when I did begin to investigate, this idea of using very simple flies and fishing them well was sort of central to what those guys tried to do. So that's what got me thinking about the very simple flies and got me experimenting with them. But to answer your question, no. When I do my trout fishing on a typical trout stream, is almost always either a 5-weight with a floating line and a reel and a leader, or a 10-car rod, you know, depending on if the water suits that kind of tackle, or just depending on my mood at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and certainly Tenkara has its limitations in reach and how you can fish certain waters. So it's not a, I guess to many people it can be the be-all, end-all, but like in your book, in your introduction, I thought it was kind of funny, the story you related about I guess it's Ishigaki.
Yes, Dr. Ishigaki.
From Japan, and when he, quoting from your book, you said, and then in a cheerful defiance of much of the lore so carefully preserved at the Catskill Center, he said, patterns don't matter. And according to Ishigaki, you can just tie a chicken feather, pretty much any old chicken feather, onto a hook, wrap it around a few times so the barbs splay, wind a little bit of tying thread up and down the shank for a body, knot the thread, call it a fly, and go fishing.
Yes.
He's a true believer in putting that fly in the right place is more important than and how you fish it, right?
Absolutely. Going back to what you said earlier, making that fly look alive. And so the Tenkara guys, depending on the characteristics of the water where they are, but a lot of times they'll just very, very slightly and very gently pulse the rod and give that fly a little jigging action and get those hackles wiggling, and the fish just can't resist.
Yeah. Let's talk about fly tying equipment and supplies. What equipment do you use? I mean, is it standard equipment? What equipment have you gotten rid of that you don't really need anymore that you found, simplifying the process?
Well, there are 52 patterns in this book, and so actually I'm still digging in the Tupperware boxes fairly often. But you wouldn't need all 52 patterns, certainly, to go fishing, But I've still got all my feathers and furs and so forth. So as far as the actual tying and equipment, I use the standard sorts of things. I use a regular vise and the various like a bobbin and hackle pliers and scissors and things like that. So they're pretty much the things that anybody uses to tie a fly. Those are what I tie it with. It's just quicker.
Yeah. I remember seeing some videos, and I can't remember who it was, but he was really good at tying flies using his hand as a vise. And I don't know if you've ever seen that done, but, on the side of the river, he could just go into his box and could tie up a fly using his hand as a vise, and boom, 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 and he had the fly tied. And I was pretty impressed with that. So you haven't gone that far yet.
I have not gone to tying in hand yet, no. I've seen people do it at fly fishing shows where they're tying full-dress salmon flies in hand, and it's a very complex procedure. But, it's an interesting thing, too. And you'll probably say his name a bunch of times tonight, but there's a guy named Chris Stewart who's the proprietor of a business called TenkaraBum.com, and he sells imported Japanese rods and lots of fly tying materials and so forth, and he's a really smart guy, and he writes a wonderful website with lots of great information on it, and we fish together from time to time. And not long ago, just within the past year, he had some stuff up online about using your hemostats that you use to to pluck a hook out of a fish's mouth, using that as a vise, and so sort of tying in hand, just clamping the hook in the hemostats and holding it in your hand and tying that way. Chris lives in New York City, as I do. Doesn't own a car, he'll rent a car to go fishing, but sometimes he just commutes up into the Hudson Valley with some really nice little trout streams on the train. And he's actually tied flies on the train, sitting on the train on the way to go fishing, using that method. Very cool.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can make things even more simpler by doing it that way. That's great. Doug McLean in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, wrote in. He says, what thinking is behind your simple fly designs? What materials do you find are most effective in tying your simple flies?
Yeah, good questions. My thinking, and the thinking of the people who've influenced me, is that there are certain, you could call them salient characteristics of any fly that really are important and what get the fish to bite. And I think aside from, those one or two characteristics in the look of a fly, probably the other stuff that's on the fly beyond that is more for our own amusement as fly tiers than it is for interesting the fish. So I'm looking for triggers and just sort of little bug-like characteristics. I think very often a segmented body is possibly the single most important trigger. It might even be just the sort of oblong shape of the body. And because as we were talking earlier, there's a lot of junk floating around in streams, and fish spend their whole days sorting them out, you know, deciding which is food and which is not. And so I think the things that end up being food tend to be little segmented, oblong things. They might have little legs on them. They might have a little tail. But those few characteristics on each fly, it might be a hackle, a wiggly hackle, is a fantastic trigger, obviously, or the segmented body, or just the fly's posture, the way it sits in the water, the way it sits on the water. So those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about when I'm making the flies. As far as the materials that I find the most effective, there are a bunch. I mean, you know, this is 500 years that we know of fly tying history. Lots of things have come into use on fishing flies, and I think I use the most common ones. Hackles, certainly, soft hackles. I absolutely love Hungarian partridge for a hackle. It's got that softness and that movement in the water, and especially the little sort of banded appearance on the legs. They look like spider legs. Very, very buggy and very important. And it's something that especially over the past year, that I've really kind of fallen in love with is tying flies with wool yarn. And that's got to be that could very well be the single oldest fly tying material of all. That's got to go back into the Dame Juliana Berner days, you know. But I think it's a terrific material, at least for subsurface flies, because, for one thing, it is so easy to use. There's a lot less fussing around than there is if you're dubbing, you know, fur onto a thread. And the qualities of the yarn itself, especially if you're using natural yarn that's got some natural variation in its texture and in its color, I think that just sort of gives the bug that, you know, what we've always called bugginess. In the book, I sort of suggest that it almost gives it a sort of random complexity that kind of suggests the complexity of a real insect when you look at it up close. So yarn is wonderful, especially for nymphs. It's a great material. Those are a couple of the examples.
I think that's one of the first materials I used out of my mother's, you know, knitting bag. Was taking her yarn and tying up woolly boogers and stuff way back when, because I didn't have the money to, you know, to buy any fancy stuff, you know.
Right.
I think we all did
yeah.
that kind of thing, you know.
Sure.
Take
sure.
what you can get. And wool is natural, you know. So it's you find yourself using more natural materials than synthetic, or does it make
I,
really
I do.
Not make
I
any
think
difference?
That's No, I do generally, and that is one. I guess that is probably one change in my approach to fly tying since I've gotten into this way of thinking about flies. I do tend to use natural materials more often, and I suppose there probably are synthetic materials that could work in many of the circumstances. I like using the natural materials. They do seem to have a certain mojo about them, and from a standpoint of, you know, again, like ease of use. You know, just wrapping on a body of yarn is just quicker and simpler than having to dub a body and then wrap it on. But, yeah, so I probably have gotten away from using a whole lot of synthetic materials. I do still use some. Yeah, one in particular, we were talking about yarn and talking about natural yarn, but, man, one thing that I had great success with over the years, and I may have to give the credit to the yarn, is the Gary LaFontaine yarn that he sort of produced and sold for his sparkle pupa flies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That tri-lobal Antron yarn. Man, I don't know. Maybe any green yarn would have worked, but I've caught an awful lot of fish on flies made from that stuff.
And yeah.
Made of not much more than that stuff. So
yeah.
There certainly are places where synthetics can be a real benefit, and especially for things like adding a little flash, especially in streamers.
Yeah. Okay, Morgan, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dig more into some of the flies you tie and how you do it.
Good.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instructions and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Morgan Lyle about simple flies. If you'd like to ask Morgan a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Morgan, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Obviously, finishing this book was a major accomplishment for you. What else are you doing?
It was a very nice accomplishment, a very gratifying thing to be able to do. And as you might expect, I'm trying to sort of make the rounds and make some appearances at fishing clubs and fly shops and so forth and talk about the book and, you know, let people know what it's about and drum up some interest in it. Trying to do some fishing. None of us has enough time to fish as much as we'd like to, but I do what I can. I live here in New York, and this is actually a very nice time of year to be fishing in New York. I'm trying to sort of overcome my trout centricity and pay attention to the saltwater fish along the coast, because this is the time of year when we have the great migration of striped bass and bluefish and false albacore and all kinds of fish just moving north to south down the east coast. And it can be just some really exciting fishing when you hit it just right. So I've been out in the salt a little bit. I've had a little bit of luck, and it's been fun.
Yeah, in fact, you know, you're talking about you know, fishing in and around the New York area. And I know my daughter lives in Midtown Manhattan right now, and, you know, she got rid of her car, and like you were saying, and, you know, yes. And you're living in Brooklyn right now, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and I did a show with, well, this was back in 2006 when I first was starting, the show with John McMurray on fly fishing for bluefish in Jamaica Bay, which is, I think, just around the corner from you, right?
It's very close by, yep.
Yeah, so, and he was saying you could almost take the subway down there and go fishing, so.
Yeah, you can. You can access the Jamaica Bay on the subway, on the A train, actually.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, where are you going to go fishing in New York? But there's so much trout fishing in upstate Pennsylvania, and then the salt water is all around you as well, so Quite a diverse fishery in reality.
It really is a very nice part of the world to live in if you like to fish. I've been doing a lot of fishing actually in western Connecticut the last couple of years and having a great time. But yeah, there's trout fishing all over. There's warm water fishing all over. Tons of carp fishing if that's your thing. And yes, the coast and Jamaica Bay. Don't forget. I mean, yeah, you know, you think of New York as a big city. You'd have to wonder where there would be natural places nearby. But that whole southern shoreline of New York City is all part of the Gateway National Recreation Area. And you'd be surprised how beautiful a lot of it is and how good the access is and the fish you can get to. I was in Jamaica Bay actually a couple of weeks ago. I was waiting, as I usually am. Obviously, you've got a little bit of you've got a big advantage in that kind of fishing if you've got a boat, because you can go to the fish and you can chase them around. If you're waiting, you need to be in the right place at the right time. But I saw some great action. I couldn't reach it, but there was lots of bait, and there were fish busting at the surface. There were actually blitzing fish, and I could look at those fish and just turn my head a few degrees to the right and see the Manhattan skyline. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's cool. We got one question from James in Alpine. I don't know where Alpine is, but he just asked, you know, what is your definition of a simple fly? And you may have covered this before, but why don't you hit it again?
I think of it as flies that are only generally made of one or two things. Maybe three materials on the absolute fanciest flies. But one or two things, not counting what I think of as the chassis of the fly, so the hook, a bead if you're using one, a little lead wire if you're using that. But I guess I'm talking about the dressing, the flies that are dressed with just one or two things. You know, a body and some hackle or something like that.
Another question, not a question, a comment. The Internet, George in South Fork, Boise, says, this guy's good. So I'm glad you're enjoying the show, George, and you were just getting started. So
thank you, George. Nice of you to say, man.
Yeah. Another question, Frank Williams in Utica, New York, wants to know, have you done any videos as a follow-up for your book?
No, and gosh, I should have. And it's nice to hear from Utica. I lived in Utica for 3 years before I moved down here to the metro New York area. And you want to talk about a nice place to live if you like to fish, Utica's fantastic. There's such a great diversity of fishing just within minutes of your home in the central New York State area. Everything from the salmon and steelhead fishing in the tributaries of Lake Ontario and the local trout streams and stillwater fishing, and your still only a few hours from the coast if you're interested in doing that, too. You're close to the Catskills. You're close to the Adirondacks. I enjoyed Utica, let me tell you. But I'm sorry, what I got talking and I forgot. What was his question?
I was just asking if you had done any videos to support the book.
No, videos, no. Gosh, I really should, and I hope to. Both of my daughters are handy with that sort of gear, and maybe if I get a little time to catch my breath, I will do some tying videos, maybe even some fishing videos. It's a great idea.
Frank also asks, where will you be attending fly tying shows? Do you have any shows scheduled that you'll be at?
I've been to, as I say, a number of fishing club meetings and sort of some fly shop get-togethers, but I think the next major one that I had my eye on is the, and I don't even know if I should say it publicly since I haven't gotten with the organizers to set it up yet, but I expect to be able to at least be tying at the fly fishing show, the Somerset, New Jersey stop of the fly fishing show, which, as you know, goes all around the country. It's far and away the world's greatest fly fishing expo, and I'd really like to be a part of that. So
I hope to
be in Somerset in January and hope to see folks there.
Yeah, I talked to Ben Ferminsky there and get on his book signing table there too.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I got to get with Ben.
Yeah. Okay. Tying flies, are there, you know, you just talked about one general rule, which is, you know, only using maybe 2, 3, 4 pieces of, you know, different kinds of material, trying to keep that down to a minimum. Are there any other general rules you follow when tying simple flies?
I go by the sort of basic traditional ways of tying flies. I do try to make my flies nice. You know, I try to tie them neatly. I try to keep the proportions good and keep a nice, neat, recognizable taper in the body and use the hackle that's the right size, you know, and things like that. So it's not as though I just whip things together in a sloppy way. I do think we ought to take care with our flies. It's a matter of personal pride and pride in your craft, and I think there's probably a tactical advantage too. There are a reason that these proportions and standards and methods have evolved over the centuries the way they have, and I think it's wise to stick to them.
Okay. Rick in North Carolina asks, Morgan, do you use competition hooks and jig-style hooks for trout flies? If so, for what type of flies?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rick. I do. Primarily, the second part of his question, for what types of flies, mainly for nymphs. And I think nymphs are probably the category of fly that's used most often in competition fishing anyway. And as I note in the book, the surge of interest in competition fly fishing in the United States over the last 5-6 years was another source of inspiration for this book, along with the Tenkara movement. And what intrigued me about that was that these guys are not necessarily terribly concerned with successfully, you know, matching a hatch or with tying a fly that takes a great deal of skill to tie. They're concerned with tying flies that catch fish because these guys are going to a lot of trouble and expense to attend these tournaments, and they fish an awful lot because they take it very, very seriously. So I think the flies that they use and they have faith in are worthwhile for us to look at and pay attention to. And very often they're using very, very simple flies. And so I've talked to a couple of folks in the book that are quoted or are talked about. Much of their inspiration comes from the European guys who've been doing this sort of thing for a lot longer than we have here in the States. But generally speaking, competition fly fishers are mostly nymphing. They're mostly using simple beadhead flies, maybe a body of pheasant tail or a body of hare's mask fur. But they don't, as a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, I think they deliberately avoid putting a lot of hackles and other appendages on a fly, of the kinds of things that we've come to think of as being sort of realistic things that imitate parts of real bugs. They avoid using them because they sort of impede a fly's ability to sink. And these guys want their flies down where the fish are quickly because they really, you know, they've got 3 hours to catch all the fish they can, so they don't mess around. So, yes, I do use competition-style hooks. I love jig hooks for nymphs. And the competition movement in general, I think, has been interesting and a lot of fun to watch and very informative to my fishing. You know, it's funny, I've covered a couple of fly fishing competition tournaments as a journalist, and I would just sit on the bank and watch the guys fish, and I was struck by how similar what they do is to Tenkara fishing. They're generally using longer rods than we're accustomed to. You know, most of us would be fishing, you know, 9-foot rods. They're generally fishing 11-footers. They use very long leaders, and much of the time, there's no actual PVC fly line coming out of the guides at all. There might be a few feet of it off the reel coming up the rod, but mostly they're fishing a 20-foot leader, and maybe 15 or 18 feet of that leader is beyond the guides, and they're making exactly the same sort of flicking casts that the Tenkara fishers do. I was struck by the similarity of it, and I think, you know, one sort of reinforced the other. Right. It was interesting to see.
Yeah. I can relate to that, too, after, you know, interviewing a few guests on our show about that kind of fishing in Europe. So, yeah, it's interesting how things, well, if you just go back and read all the books, I mean, fly fishing changes a lot. And it goes in circles, and it goes back, and it goes forward. But it's always interesting, and I think that's why we all love it so much. But
absolutely. And, you know, yeah. and the different sorts of trends and ideas that come to the fore are a lot of fun. We really are in a golden age of it right now, I think, mainly because of the, you know, just the tremendous communication that's been made available by technology and social media in recent years. Everyone can share their ideas, and, you know, sort of fly fishing, I think, has really evolved into a lot of kinds of specialties, and it's all good. I mean, it's all very good stuff. So.
Yeah, I remember Rick Takahashi, who I've interviewed a couple of times on my show, and I remember him talking about his excitement at just going into, you know, Michael's craft stores or places like that and just looking for new materials to play with, you know, because it's like a kid in a candy store. You know, you don't have to even go to the fly shop. It's like sometimes more interesting to go to a craft store or something and look around. But and I remember making wings out of the old TVAC, you know, disc covers for floppy disks from the computers.
Oh, yes, that's a great idea.
And coloring them with pens because they made nice wings for caddis or something like that. So, yeah,
absolutely,
you never know.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like a dryer sheet, only a little more substantial, right? A little more rugged.
Yeah. James, again, in Alpine, Wyoming is where he's at. Alpine, Wyoming. Okay, James.
Oh, nice.
And he says, give us your favorite simple dry fly, nymph, wet fly, and streamer. Well, guess what, James? That's exactly what we were going to do next. So your wishes are our command. So let's take them one at a time here, Morgan, and talk about wet flies first. And just have you, you know, like pick one out of your book that you is one of your favorites and tell us what it is, you know, and what it represents, how you tie it, materials you use. And just kind of walk us through that, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about how you might fish that fly.
Sure. Well, it's always tough to be asked to pick one favorite fly. I think most people might have trouble with that idea. But if you want to start with a wet fly, and two come to mind, so right away,
okay,
I'm already
two.
Having trouble choosing. But the first one that I'll mention, and because I think it's such a beautiful fly and it's got a tactical advantage too, and it's a very old pattern called the Starling and Hurl. And it's a very simple, it's a wet fly, it's tied on an unweighted hook, on just a regular sort of standard wet fly or nymph hook. And the body is peacock hurl, and the hackle is starling. Now, both of those materials are just fabulous materials. I think anybody who's spent much time fly fishing for trout at all knows just how magical peacock hurl can be as a fly material, and whether that's because of the texture of it or because of that sort of iridescent purplish-greenish color, for whatever the reason, fish just absolutely love it. So this is a fly that uses that for the body, and then that starling hackle, it's got those same soft, wavy qualities, and really, you know, it's the fibers taper to really beautiful tips on the end, which sort of suggests a living thing as opposed to just a piece of junk floating around the stream. But what I really like about using starling is that you can tie small. I had mentioned Hungarian partridge hackle earlier, and it is fantastic stuff, but it's tough to tie small flies, 16s and 18s or even 20s, with it because the feathers are just too big. Starling are small birds, and you can tie very good flies that you know, where the proportions come out just perfect with little starling feathers. So that's another thing I like about that fly. So if there's a, you know, if there are small dark caddis on the water, which they often are here in my part of the country, or if there are midges on the water, or just if there's nothing in particular and you're just looking for something that's a good attractor-style fly, I think that's a great one. I really love it. And as I say, man, I mean, that's, you know, hundreds of years old. So
yeah,
that's one that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that's simple. There's no doubt about it. You know, her old body and wind that starling hackle around the front, you're done.
You're done. Just a couple turns of starling hackle, yeah, and very effective.
Could tie a lot of those in an hour, couldn't you?
Well, yeah, and that's honestly, that's really part of the appeal of it for me. And especially these days, you know, I do live in Brooklyn now. I live in an apartment. I don't have a lot of space. I don't have a big man cave with pegboards on the wall with half a fly shop hanging on them. So I got to sort of make some choices, you know. And tying this way is manageable for, you know, I'm kind of busy and I don't have a lot of space. So this simple fly stuff kind of works well for me right now, you know.
Yeah. And you just fish this as a standard wet fly, down and across kind of?
Down and across, you know, in the film, a few inches under the surface, definitely in the top part of the water column. This is when fish are active and they're up and about and they're aware of that space, you know, in the upper part of the stream. It's not something you'd use to go looking for fish down deep along the bottom. It can be very good during a hatch. And as I say, it can be a good sort of attractor fly, even if there isn't any particular hatch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. And what about the other one you were wanting to tell us about?
I was going to mention what is known as the killer kabari, and here comes my friend Chris Stewart again. But to talk about the killer kabari, and maybe this will segue into the next part of the question, I'll begin to explain the killer bug. And this is the single fly that most inspired this book, the killer bug. It's nothing more than yarn on a hook. You don't even use thread. You do use a little bit of copper wire, but there's no tying thread at all. And that's all it is. It's in the book, of course. You just wind on a layer or two of copper wire on the hook, which gives the fly a little extra weight. And I used to think that it sort of gives a little glow from the inside of the fly. That might not be true. I don't know. But the thing certainly looks like it's got a little glow to it in the water. But anyway, you put on this, you know, just a couple layers of copper wire, stop with the wire back by the bend of the fly, bend of the hook, and then you just take this yarn, and I suppose it could be any yarn, but we do have some opinions about what kind of yarn it ought to be, and you attach the yarn the same way that you would attach the thread when you begin to make any other fly. You just sort of cross the material over itself, and you start at the head, and you wind down to the bend, back to the head, back to the bend, bind that down with a couple turns of the copper wire that's waiting for you there, and make a simple little knot right there at the bend of the fly, cut everything off, and you're done. That's the killer bug. As I say, that fly was invented by Frank Sawyer in England, who's probably best known to most people as the guy who invented the pheasant tail nymph, probably the best nymph of all time. And when I began experimenting with it, it was Chris Stewart at 10carabum.com who, it's not strictly speaking a 10-cara fly, but it's sort of in that same spirit, and it was all but forgotten until just a few years ago. And Chris sort of brought it up and brought it to our attention, and a bunch of us began experimenting with the killer bug, and man, did I start catching a lot of trout on that fly. Now, I happen to think that it looks an awful lot like a lot of living things in the water. It's been suggested that it looks a lot like a crane fly larva. Frank Sawyer said he thought it looked like a caddis pupa. It could be a scud. It could be just a sort of general purpose grub. But for what really intrigued me about it was that it's so simple. Yarn on a
hook. I mean, there's like nothing to it.
Nothing to it. And keep in mind, this guy, you know, Frank Sawyer, was an expert angler, an expert fly tyer. He was the river keeper on the Avon River in England. He was in charge of taking care of a stretch of the river that was owned by, or at least leased by, and probably still is, by an association of British military officers and retired officers. So this was, you know, a pretty high-end clientele who expected good fishing, and he was able to provide it. So he knows what he's doing on the water and at the vise, and he's more than capable of making flies that have tails and separate abdomens and thoraxes and wing cases and hackles and ribs and antennae and anything else you want to put on a fly. And he did make lots of flies like that. But for whatever reason, he chose to make this fly with nothing more than yarn on a hook. And in fact, as I understand it, it was Lee Wolf who suggested that he name it the killer bug. But that fly was what really got me thinking about this whole idea of very, very simple flies in the first place. Now, to get back to the question, so Chris Stewart sort of brought the killer bug to everybody's attention, and we all had a lot of fun with it, and then he put a hackle on the front. See, even us simple fly guys can't leave well enough alone. We have to fiddle with these things. So Chris put originally a hen pheasant hackle on it, and then he switched and started using the Hungarian partridge, and he named it the killer kabari. Kabari is the Japanese word for trout fly, as you probably discussed with Daniel Gallardo when you had him on the show. And I don't know if that hackle makes a great difference or not, but I'll tell you what, man, it's a heck of a good fly.
Yeah, now you mentioned, well, you didn't really say, but the body you've got here in your book is Oyster Jameson's Shetland Spindrift Wool Yarn. Now, is that, I'm not familiar with that, is that something you find at a fly shop, or is that something you find at a wool shop?
You find that in knitting shops. Yarn that people use to make sweaters and scarves and stuff. But it's great
stuff.
Okay,
so it's kind of a brand name?
It's a brand, yep. I believe the Shetland refers to the Shetland Islands in northern Scotland, so I kind of think it's got some good trout credibility right there. And, again, Chris Stewart, you know, he found a color of that that pretty much approximated the color of the yarn that Frank Sawyer used for his killer bug. So he began stocking it at his business, and then he started looking into other colors that this company sells for knitting. And there's a whole range of colors, so you really could use this yarn for almost any color of nymph or wet fly that you wanted to tie.
Yeah.
So there are several colors that I like to use. But, yeah, that oyster color is a very good color for making. It's actually sort of considered the Utah variant of the killer bug. Some guys out in Utah discovered that particular color of Shetland spindrift yarn and began making their fly out of that.
Yeah. It looks, in the pictures at least, from what I can tell, kind of variegated kind of. It's there's light and dark browns in there that look very earthy.
Yes.
And buggy, kind of like almost like Cares Mask kind of coloring. Only a little bit.
Yeah, right. That's a big part of the beauty of Hare's Mask is that there is, you know, so many different shades of fur on the mask that
right.
end up being in your dubbing blend, and I really do think that helps. And you're absolutely right. That variegation in that yarn, I really think that's the secret sauce there. I think that probably works a lot better than if you just went and got, you know, sort of an acrylic yarn from a craft store that was, you know, kind of monochromatic, all one solid color. I think that natural wool yarn with those natural variations makes a big difference.
Yeah, very good. Okay, let's take another quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk more about some of the flies you've created. So hang with us here just a few more seconds. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species as well. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. And there you can view their fishing products and guide services that they offer both in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Morgan Lyle about simple flies. If you'd like to ask Morgan a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Morgan, you're doing a great job. Keep going.
Thank you, Roger. I'm having a great time. And man, it was nice to hear that spot for Housatonic River Outfitters. If any of your listeners haven't had the chance yet to fish the Housatonic or the Farmington, I can't recommend them highly enough. They're just great rivers.
Yeah. George wrote in again from Southwark, Boise. He says, I was born in Flatbush, Brooklyn. My grandfather used to take me to Sheepshead Bay for snapper fishing. Now I hear Utica. I used to live in New Hartford, suburb of Utica. And he's talking about you. Did you fish West Canada Creek?
Oh, my gosh.
What flies would you use for fishing Jones Beach? Are there any bluefish there?
George, actually, I got a pretty nice bluefish last Friday evening. I only had about an hour and a half to fish, but there was a ton of bait in the water, not at Jones Beach, but up on the north shore of Long Island, near to where I used to live, a spot that I know pretty well. I used to go quite often. That was quite a fish. Bluefish are really something to catch. They're very strong and very mean. I really did begin to fear for the rod at one point. But what a small world. I mean, my goodness, the West Canada Creek, I fished it every chance I got, and there are a couple of flies in the book that worked very well there. One of them is Jack Gartside's soft hackle streamer. And I know I burned up the whole question about, you know, what kind of dry and wet and nymph and streamer to use, but that's probably a good choice right there for a streamer. The Gartside soft tackle streamer, it's really nothing more than just some a marabou feather palmered on the front of the hook and maybe a couple strands of flashaboo inside it, and you can wrap a feather on the front just sort of for decoration, but obviously the real important part of that fly is that marabou. And again, it looks alive. It moves in the water. It's translucent. Because it's such a light fly, basically of one light feather tied to a hook, it's so easy to cast. And boy, did that fly work well on the West Canada on those brown trout.
Cool. Well, let's talk about some simple nymphs. You already described the killer bug, which was one of those. So let's pick out another one, Morgan, and tell us about another one of your simple nymphs.
Well, another one that I've been using lately is it's called the peacock hurl nymph, and that's all it is peacock hurl on a hook, period. You could put a bead on the front, I suppose, if you wanted to. There was a time I never would have believed that a fly that simple would work. I would say, where's the rest of it? But believe me, it works. And, well, I'll just explain how I learned about that one. It was on Facebook, social media again, and it was Bob Clouser, of all people, who had posted a photo of his fly box, his trout fly box. He had three rows of this thing in there. And I contacted him, and I said, is that fly really nothing but peacock hurl on a hook? And he said, yes, and it's maybe one of the best flies in the box. So I've been fooling around with that, and it works very well. I think it's just the quality of the material. And you think of all the great flies that are made out of peacock hurl, like the Zug Bug, the Leadwing Coachman, the Prince. And I'm going to guess that the peacock hurl is probably what makes all of them so effective. You know, and nymphs, I think, were going back to my experimenting with the killer bug and becoming fascinating with the simple flies approach, I find it really fascinating that very, very simple nymphs work so well, because I think they're seen more closely than any other style of fly. You know, if it's a dry fly or an emerger, it's floating overhead, it's kind of silhouetted against the sky. I don't think the trout often get a great look at them. A streamer is going by quickly, and that kind of, or even if it's going by slowly, but that's sort of, you know, the trout makes a pretty quick snap decision about whether to grab a streamer or not. But a nymph, when you fish them right, when you get them right down there to eye level with the trout, and the thing is just sort of bouncing along at the speed of the current, and the trout has all afternoon to look at it, and yet some of the simplest nymphs are some of the most effective ones. And so that really was got me thinking that there must be something to this. Now, and I sort of mentioned the Copper John in the book is maybe sort of the antithesis of this approach, and I certainly don't mean to denigrate the Copper John or John Barr. It's a beautiful fly, and I've caught a ton of fish on it, but it's got a lot of parts and a lot of tying steps, and I don't doubt that it works great. I know for a fact it works great. But the very, very simple ones, I think, work just about as well.
Well, you know, and there's a lot to be said with going simple, because I'm not a particularly fast tier, you know, and there's some flies I just choose not to tie, you know, like a lot of dry flies with wings and stuff. I'll just go buy them because, you know, I'd rather be fishing than tying those. So you know, and then many times it kind of breaks your heart sometimes when you lose a fly that, you know, especially maybe on the first cast or something. And, you know, you just spent, you know, 25 minutes tying that thing, you know. It's kind of heartbreaking. So
right. There it is behind you in a tree.
Yeah, and it's like, damn, you know. It's, but, so, you know, simpler is making a lot more sense to me here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another one of my influencers, Bob Wyatt, he refers to flies as being like ammo, you know?
Yeah.
Expendable, quick, cheap, easy to make. Have lots of them, have them in the right sizes, and don't be afraid to throw them around.
Yeah. So, good. Let's talk then about dry flies.
Yeah.
So,
and then that's, actually, that's a good segue into to my favorite dry fly, at least these days, and where I learned about it was from the writer Bob Wyatt in his book, What Trout Want, The Educated Trout and Other Myths. And that's a fun book to read and very enlightening, and I highly recommend it to everyone. It's Bob Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. And Bob knows what he's talking about. He grew up in Western Canada, but he lived for a long time in Scotland, and these days he lives in New Zealand. And, you know, everybody, I think, considers the New Zealand trout to be some of the toughest trout in the world. And he only fishes very simple flies for those fish. What's, I think, the key is that he fishes them very carefully and very skillfully. But Bob, I guess you'd say he popularized the pattern because he takes pains to say he didn't invent it. But this is what I fish for most of my dry fly fishing now. It's a very simple fly. It's tied on a curved hook or even a clinkhammer-style hook, and it works in the same way as a clinkhammer special. And it's got a body of hare's mask fur and a wing that's just a little sprig of comparadun hair, you know, coastal deer hair. That's all there is to it. And then a little bit more of the hare's ear fur on the front of the fly up to the eye. So it's
What's
a very, very simple pattern. This is the deer hair emerger.
Okay.
Deer hair emerger. And I would never hesitate to use this fly. I've caught rising trout on it all over the place in all different kinds of water. And I suspect that what's really important about that is the reason that fly works so well is the reason that the clinkhammer special works so well, because that fly isn't sitting on the surface or even in the surface. That deer hair wing is poking up through the surface, and I think it looks pretty buggy. And it also gives the angler something to watch, but the body of the fly is actually almost perpendicular to the surface. It's really hanging down at a very sharp angle under the water. And for one thing, I think that's a posture that a lot of emerging nymphs find themselves in as they're trying to get out of that shuck and turn into winged insects. And for the other thing, it's just visible. It's just so much easier to see.
Yeah.
And
that
really is my...
Yeah, the shape of the hook is very important in that one, it looks like, to get that effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the hanging thing. What about, Roger Campbell in Cheyenne, Wyoming wrote in, he says, your book has wingless dry flies. Are there any situations where you would advocate adding wings to dry flies, such as selective trout on slow, clear streams, or do you believe that wings on dry flies are unnecessary for all fishing conditions?
Yeah, I know this is, you know, a thing that has been talked about a lot over the years, how important the wings are. I think it was Vince Marinaro in Pennsylvania who, you know, through his own experimentation and underwater photography and so forth, he concluded that the wings, the tips of the wings, were actually the things that a trout would see first. But I don't take that approach. I really don't bother putting wings on any of my dry flies unless I just happen to feel like doing it for the fun of it. I think the body and the posture is much more important. The hackle's there to help the fly float and maybe to suggest its legs. But no, I don't use wings on my dry flies. Except, as I say, you know, like the deer hair emerger, for example, that has a wing, but that's also the structure that, you know, keeps the fly floating in the film and also, again, something for the angler to watch when the fly is drifting. But so no.
Yeah, and
no,
I noticed you have this snowshoe hair emerger. Now, what are you using for that?
It's the same fly. The idea of that is that when you want to get down into the small sizes, the 18s and 20s or even smaller, the snowshoe hair is just a little bit easier to work with maybe than with deer hair to make a wing at that point. And for that matter, I think CDC would probably work pretty well too, especially on a fly that small. And this is, I'm starting to see more and more patterns like this. Out your way, Charlie Craven,
the
Colorado fly tire. He's got a fly, and of course Charlie can tie all kinds of flies, and they're all great. But he's got one he calls the mole fly. It's, I think, a very similar thing. It's tied on a curved hook. It has a dubbed body, and the wing is just a little tuft of CDC up toward the front that just sort of keeps the fly from slipping under the film. And it looks like a wing, and it does give you something to watch. But again, you know, he's got a body that's either, you know, hanging a little below the surface or maybe at times a lot below the surface. So I think there's really something to this idea of damp flies, if you will, that don't sit on top of the water but sit in it, you know, or even a little under the surface.
Brian in Snoqualmie, Washington, asked, do you have any suggestions on tying with CDC and keeping it simple?
You know, I don't have any suggestions other than the conventional ways of tying with it. The fly on the cover of my book is the CDC Elk by Hans Weilenman from Holland, and it's a great all-purpose fly. It's what I would use now instead of an elk hair caddis. It's basically the same kind of idea. It's a wing of elk hair or deer hair and a body, but it doesn't have any hackle. But the body in that case actually is made of CDC, and it's pretty clever how he thought of to make this fly. He sort of pulls all the CDC fibers together straight into one long thing and ties that on at the back of the hook and then winds the CDC onto the hook as a dubbing, you know, as any body material you would wind on. And as you get winding closer and closer to the front of the hook, some of the fibers that you've been holding just kind of let go and sort of splay out to the side, so they may be suggesting some legs, or at least there'll be something that'll be giving a little movement there to the fly. Now, as far as a tying trick for that, Hans does suggest, because CDC can be slippery, it can be a little tricky to operate with, he'll tie that, and exact procedure's in the book, it's actually slipping my mind at the moment, I haven't tied one in a while, but if you wrap your thread over the CDC a couple of times, how exactly did that work? And then go underneath the CDC with a couple of turns, and then come over it again. It sort of locks it into place, if you know what I mean, and keeps it from moving around. CDC can be a little tricky to mess with.
Yeah, I was trying to find what was the name of that fly?
CDC Elk. It would be in the dry fly section of the book.
Oh yeah, yeah. Page 103.
Yeah. Yeah, you just tie it on at the bend of the hook and then slip the thread underneath the CDC for a couple turns and then come back over it again. And that just sort of helps lock it in place.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that, you know, whether you're tying, you know, tying on CDC as a body material or a wing or anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Good, good. Okay, coming down to the end of things here. So, do you want to consider that one another dry fly, or do you want to highlight anything else?
Absolutely, by all means, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so the CDC and elk.
CDC elk, you know, anytime you've got a caddis on the water and you have reason to think that the fish are on the adult caddis, and for that matter, Hans says that he's done very well with that fly as a mayfly imitation. Even though it's got a down wing instead of the upright wing that we usually think of for mayflies, I guess it works quite well in mayfly hatches too. And it's just, as a good all-purpose attractor fly.
Yeah, I noticed you've also got some beetles and ants and those kind of things in here too, which are great simple flies as well.
Well, they are.
Very well in Colorado.
I don't think most people use terrestrials enough, and I'm more guilty than anybody. I should, you know, sometimes I think it would be a cool exercise to fish an entire season with just terrestrial flies, you know, with no aquatic flies at all. I bet you could do pretty well.
Yeah, I bet you so, too. I've got a lake just down from my house here that I fish all the time, and, you know, I don't know how many times I've caught fish on just a, anything buggy on the surface, you know, that represents a cricket or a grasshopper or those kind of things. And nothing can be happening, no hatches at all, and those things always produce, you know, and it's just something buggy looking on the surface, and they love it.
Sure. Yeah. Just a muddler minnow fished on top as a hopper imitation, yeah.
There you go, yeah. Okay, streamers. Let's look at a couple there. Strikes your fancy there, Morgan?
Well, I caught that big bluefish on the Bob Popovic's bucktail deceiver. That's a great simple fly. It's made of nothing but just some bucktail tied on a particular way. It's sort of successive bunches of bucktail going up the fly. But there's a wide variety of things. I think if I was to pick a material that most impresses me on a streamer, it would be a tail, which I guess really is the sort of the body of the fly in this case, because it sort of suggests the body of the fish. But for a tail of saddle hackle, that stuff just has such unbelievable movement in the water, and just the natural taper and the fluttering action of it and the undulating action. I've caught an awful lot of fish, mostly saltwater fish, because that's where I tend to do most of my streamer fishing, is in saltwater, with flies made of that have tails made of saddle hackle. So I'm thinking first of all of conventional deceivers, the regular lefty deceiver. The Seaducer is a fly that there are a couple of versions of in the book. And sometimes I have caught fish on nothing more than just a couple of saddle hackles tied in at the eye of the hook, and that is it. Uh-huh. Nothing else to them. There are a couple of occasions where they really happen to suggest the local bait, these little things called killifish, very, very well, with a grizzly hackle, you know, or a dyed grizzly. So, that streamers are a lot of fun. I'd mentioned the Gartside soft hackle streamer made of marabou. There's a great Chico Fernandez pattern in the book called Chico's Marabou Madness, which I've been having a little luck with lately. Chico has a new book out too, by the way.
Yeah,
there's an interview with Chico.
I'm not sure. I think. On December 2nd, he's going to be on Fly Fishing for Redfish. Yeah. So we're going to have him as well. Yeah, I saw him in there. A lot of marabou with that one, huh?
Yeah. It's almost entirely made of marabou, and just so much movement in the water, so much life. And again, it's translucent, and it's lightweight and easy to cast, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, the saddle hackles, something has to be happening there with the, you know, the barbed look of those, you know. So many fish have bars on the side, and I wonder if that gives it a, you know, if that's the attraction with those.
I'm sure it does, meaning with grizzly saddles, with those barbed markings. Absolutely, yeah. Like, I mean, they kind of suggest par marks on juvenile fish, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. It's probably what makes them work. Yeah, good. Okay, let's see what else we got here. We kind of talked about this, but Rick in Huntersville, North Carolina, this came off the internet. Is there a particular material, natural or synthetic, that you most often use to imitate wings on simple dry flies?
Yeah, most of the time, as I say, because I'm fishing these deer hair emerger patterns, my wings tend to be comparadon type hair, so coastal deer hair. And, I've been using, we're all familiar with flies like the comparadon, like the haystack, things that honestly, in sort of the 70s and the 80s, kind of knocked the Catskill-style dry fly with its stiff hackle on the front, kind of knocked it out of first place when it comes to fish catching, because they float flush in the surface, and the deer hair, I think it does a good job of suggesting an insect's wing, and it makes a nice durable fly, a fly that floats well, a fly that you can see well, and they're very simple to make.
Mm-hmm. I know I didn't see anything in there in the way of like parachutes in your dry flies. Do you ever use that?
No, I don't bother with them. I really don't.
Okay.
I mean, I've tied tons of parachutes over the years, caught lots of fish on them, but I don't even bother using them anymore, honestly. I get just as good a result with, like I say, simple deer hair wings.
Yeah. Another question from the internet, Gene in Woodstock, Maryland, asks, what's the best material for tying hackles on soft hackle flies?
Again, my top choice would be Hungarian partridge. just fantastic stuff. And there are actually a couple of different colors of it on a skin. I do recommend go ahead and get yourself a skin rather than getting the packaged feathers, because you'll just have a better variety of sizes to choose from. I think the feathers tend to be in better shape. And, you know, you do get some, despite what I said about them being for larger sizes of flies, 12s and 14s, you can get some pretty small ones down at the base of the skin. And you get a couple of different colors, too. There are some that are mostly black and white, and there are some that are mostly brown with black markings. So, yeah, Hungarian partridge is fantastic stuff. I love starling. I love hen pheasant. It isn't always easy to find, but if you come across one, you see one online, or if you're at a fly fishing show, great stuff for making soft tackles with. Those would probably be the top three, and I think people have probably experimented with lots of... Oh, and hen. How could I forget good old-fashioned just regular chickens? Regular right. Hen hackle is just fantastic for soft tackles. And that's one where you really have a wide range of sizes and colors. It's very inexpensive. It's easy to use. And yeah, I like tying with hen.
Another question... it doesn't say who, they didn't say who this was from, but it says, what simple flies that you use also work well during match-the-hatch situations on the stream? And we didn't really talk about that. You know, so many people are in, you know, match-the-hatch. You know, you're trying to get this exact fly. How do you know, again, you're just using flies that are representative, right? I mean, you're not trying to match it exactly.
Well, yes and no. It sort of depends okay. where you are. I do think you will come across situations where you had better have a fly that looks an awful lot like the real bugs. And I'm thinking of probably a lot of the big western tailwaters you'll find that situation. I'm thinking of a pretty big tailwater here in New York, the Delaware River, where I think it's pretty necessary. It's they're long, flat pools, cold water, and they just get fantastic hatches of what we here in the East, we call them sulfurs, all summer long. And they're little yellow or orangish yellow mayflies, size 16, 18, roughly. You know, the sizes vary. And they're on the water pretty much every day from June through well into August. And so, you know, these trout have just eaten hundreds and hundreds of these things. They eat them all day long. And I think at some point, anything that isn't a sulfur just doesn't really register as food with them. So, yeah. I do think there are times when you need to match a hatch. And so there are patterns in the book that you can adapt to your local hatches. And in that particular case, the one I would use are the wingless Catskill style dries. And I would just get the right body color, whether you want to make it of dubbing or of a hackle stem body, like a red quill kind of fly, but in the right colors. That's the situation. And as a matter of fact, talking about Long Island, there's a couple of great little coastal spring creeks there. Placid water, good hatches, smart fish, and you really need to take some care to show them the right thing, too. And that's probably what I would go to there. They're delicate and light. They land very nicely, so they don't, you know, spook the fish in the water. And that would probably be the way I'd go about matching a mayfly hatch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Question, a specific question on presentation here from Mohammed in South Africa. He wrote in and says, I've experienced a day at the river with huge quantities of caddis hatching, but the fish refuse to take my dry fly offering, sometimes nosing the fly and even following my dry fly. What's the reason for that, and what fly would have worked? Would you have, I guess, chosen to work?
Mohammed, I feel your pain. This very same thing has happened to me a lot of times. I think it's probably happened to a lot of us, especially in caddis hatches for some reason. Fish just it can be really difficult to figure out their behavior when that's going on. But I would suggest that if you've got a lot of caddis on the water and there's a lot of surface activity, but your standard floating dry flies aren't working for you, you might want to try a wet fly just below the water. One of the simple patterns, a partridge in green or a partridge in yellow or a partridge in orange, one of those types of things that would, I guess, work a little more as sort of an emerger style pattern. And I wouldn't be afraid to give them some movement too, and along with trying a dead drift. But boy, they can really be maddening, those caddis hatches. I've gotten skunked in some pretty good ones. So I understand what he's asking about there. I wish I had a better answer for you. I don't know. I suppose, you know, if we knew all that, too much of that stuff, fishing wouldn't be as much fun. But it is nice to catch a few fish now and then. So, But yeah, I would suggest trying, you know, going just a little bit below the surface with a soft hackle fly with lots of nice wiggly hackle.
Okay. And then another one on the internet. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I'll throw it out at you. It's a striped bass question. Phil McCartney wrote in, he says, what are the main factors in creating flies that catch striped bass when they are not focused on a worm hatch?
Yeah, good question. You know, as trout sometimes in a blanket mayfly hatch, you know, have a lot of one particular kind of food source to choose from, stripers tend to find themselves in that situation too with the big schools of bait. So it's probably a good idea to try to fly if that looks like the prevailing bait in the area. Here again in my part of the country, the bait that's in the water right now is something that we call peanut bunker. They're really juvenile menhaden is what the fish are called. They're like a little herring, and they tend to be anywhere from an inch and a half to 3 inches long. And they're pretty easy to imitate with a lot of fairly standard streamers. And so, yeah, in fact, a lot of the saltwater surf casting guys, and I don't mean fly fishermen, but guys who fish with spinning rods and plugs and spoons and gear like that, they've adopted the term match the hatch when they're talking about using a lure that resembles the prevailing bait. So it's sort of the same idea. If the bass are keyed in on a particular thing, then try to show them a fly that looks like that thing. But the other thing is, when they literally have tens of thousands of these things in front of them, if you do manage to perfectly imitate one of those fish, well, guess what? Then yours is just one among tens of thousands, and most of those tens of thousands of bait fish are going to survive, and your fly might too. So sometimes I don't think it's a terrible idea to change it up and show them something that looks different.
Yeah, yeah.
If you think about how the
natural world works, as many times the prey is something that's been wounded or is, you know, deficient in some way, shape, or form, whether it's an antelope or a menhaden or, you know, a spent fly, you know, a dry fly, you know, that makes them look a little bit different, you know, than the others. So, yeah.
It does, and they're the ones that get the attention and the fish will go after, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. One final question. George in South Fork, Boise again. Says, what is your favorite dry caddis pattern? Wings of elk hair, turkey wing, synthetic? And then he just added a note, admittedly, trout prefer the emerger, but. So.
No, great question, but elk hair, absolutely. The CDC elk and elk. Or even just your standard elk hair caddis. But if you're looking for a, you know, a sort of a downwing caddis dry fly imitation, that's how I would go. I have experimented some over the years with different sorts of feather bodies and so forth, and I keep coming back to elk hair. Good stuff.
Okay, good. All right, well, time to wrap things up here. Morgan, we're out of time, but stick with me here because we're going to give away your book here in just a couple minutes. Simple Flies, and that's going to be courtesy of Stackpole Books. We're also going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So hang with us, folks, for just a few more minutes, and we'll give all these great prizes away, and maybe you'll be the lucky winner. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute to give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. And if you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure to do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes we have to offer. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show by email to and provide you with information on how to receive your gifts. So, So first, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, if you haven't been a member yet of the Federation, or you have been in the past, be sure to check them out, fedflyfishers.org. A great organization to support. They do a lot in the way of conservation efforts, and they deal with everything from cold water, warm water, and salt water. So check them out. So we're going to give that away first, and let me fire up my database here. Let's see here. Hold on, folks. And, okay, pick a winner. Go pick a winner for me. Frank Williams in New York. Hey, a New Yorker got that
one. All right.
Go, Morgan. Frank Williams. I don't know where in New York, but he's in New York. So congratulations, Frank. Got yourself a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. Okay, how about we're going to give away a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. I think you said you've written for them, right, Morgan?
I have, yes.
Yeah, cool. Amato Books. Amato Books publishes all kinds of periodicals and books, so be sure to check them out as well. And Al Laurent in Oklahoma is our winner there. Al Laurent, and congratulations, Al. I'm sure you'll enjoy that, too. Hope you're tired, because that's what it's all about. So congrats with that. All right, so now let's, Morgan, let's give away a copy of your book, Simple Flies, courtesy of Stackpole Books and Headwater Books. And a great, you know, it's kind of fun to just think about revisiting some of these simple patterns again. Almost like a relief, you know what I mean? It's like, wow, yeah. I can knock a bunch of these out quickly, you know, and that's kind of cool to just even think about. So that's why I was like tying midges, you know? My midge box is always full.
Sure. Little thread and you're done.
Yeah, yeah.
So, although as time goes along, it gets harder and harder to see what you're doing. But, you know, you get a good pair of reading glasses and you're in business.
That's it. Yeah, that's the problem. Okay, so let's give this away. Here's the question. Morgan described a bunch of simple flies tonight, but what was the simplest fly he described tonight out of his examples? What's the name of the simplest fly that he talked about tonight? I got the first one is killer bug. I don't think that is the simplest. Would you agree, Morgan? I think there's a simpler one you mentioned.
Well, I don't know. You could make the case that it's a tie. The killer bug and the peacock curl fly are both pretty doggone simple. They're basically one material each.
Okay,
I think the judges could accept the killer bug.
The killer bug? Okay. So, James, you got it there in Alpine, Wyoming. Killer bug, and the other one, and I could see how either one could be it, would be the peacock curl as well. So, both of them very simple, basically just one wrap around and you're done.
Yep.
So, just pick your material. So, James, send me in the same box that you just answered the question in. Send me your address, and I have your name and I have your email address already, but send me your shipping address so we can get Stackpole to send you out a book directly from the publisher. So congratulations. Thanks for playing, folks. And let's see here. Dave Wilhelm in Minneapolis, you would have won two, but you were, let's see here, Twelve seconds later. So that's how close it comes out in these contests. It's just 12 seconds earlier, David, and you would have won. So anyway, I know that doesn't make you feel good, but sometimes you wonder about how close these things are. Okay. Well, congrats to James, and thanks, everybody, for playing tonight and paying attention. We had a great show tonight. Morgan, I really want to thank you for being with us. It was a pleasure and very informative and fun. You made my job easy. So Thanks.
Roger, it really was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And thanks to everybody who contributed to the conversation.
Yeah, great, great. Yeah, we've got a great audience out there. They always come up with some fantastic questions. Well, hopefully you've all found the archive on our website. If you're new to Ask About Fly Fishing, look for it. There's a couple of links to it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page. And in the archive, you'll find shows. There's over 220 shows in there now. You can search by keyword, a person's name, trout, tarpon, name of a river, whatever you want, and you're going to find all kinds of different shows we've done, and it's just a great learning center. Our next broadcast is going to be on November 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, I'll be interviewing Tom Boyd, and our topic for the show will be saltwater's greatest game fish. Tom has fished the salt for more than 50 years and has done exhaustive research on fish behavior, spawning, migration patterns, and bait fish. Listen in to hear Tom talk about some of the greatest game fish and how to catch them on a fly. We'd like to also thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Headwater Books, Front Range Anglers, and our other sponsors for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.